Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, May 28th. Today we talk to a coffee grower on the Big Island. How are tariffs affecting one of Hawaii's most well-known exports? We check in on the well-being of our farmers, how funding has dried up for a program designed to help address the mental health of those who toil the earth. We get the latest on President Trump's big, beautiful bill now that it's passed the House. What's in store for green energy? Plus, ever wonder how honey creepers got that signature curved beak? We talk with the scientist who helps us solve the mystery. And jazz and blue lovers will be congregating at a Kohala Coast Resort for the 12th Annual Music Festival at the Mauna Kea. Ralph Galston is part of Rusty's Hawaiian Coffee. It's a family business that grows, roasts, and distributes coffee. Rusty's his father-in-law. Galston also runs Isla Custom Coffees, which finds markets in the U.S. and beyond for green coffee, the unroasted beans. He recently returned from a trade show in China and talked with the Conversation's D.W. Gibson about how the tariffs are affecting coffee growers in Hawaii.
I think they're still concerns about what it means when the 90 days ends. And what people are very hopeful for is that there will be a long-term agreement that sets the tariffs at a level that can be worked on in the future. I think right now, if I remember correctly, they've rolled back to about 30%. China's reciprocal tariff is currently at 10% generally. And I think that's a level that people are used to and that they feel like they can do business with. So I think there's a sense of hope that whatever agreement comes between the two nations, that they level somewhere near there and that it can be standardized for the somewhat near future so that people can begin to plan around what they expect those tariffs to be.
And that level that you said is more doable is that 10% on the Chinese side of goods coming into their country. That's the more doable level, you think?
I think it's certainly helpful for us as people looking to export to coffee drinkers in China and coffee businesses there. As long as it's not something exorbitant, I think people feel like they can manage it and still kind of get a product that they would want to have and that their customers may want to have as well.
Well, you know, America abounds with coffee drinkers. So why do American growers, specifically, let's say Hawaiian growers, need international markets?
Well, I think it's a couple of reasons. There's a tradition and culture for one thing. Some of the earliest Hawaiian growers were Japanese, and they dried their coffee on raised screens that were above their houses. They called them hoshidanas. So there's always been a tie with Japan in particular and other countries in the Asia-Pacific Rim. Obviously, we have a high price for our coffee because cost of production is very high when we're growing coffee in the state of Hawaii. And so we've always needed a certain amount of exports to help with our business. That's the majority of our coffee still goes to the United States. But having that 25-30% or what have you that may go to markets in Japan or Korea or China or Europe or the Middle East is important for us not just to have different options for sales, which should help to make sure the crop is flowing smoothly and people are being able to stay profitable, but also to keep the name of Hawaii coffee known amongst the coffee drinking world, which is quite international. And that name and getting our quality out there has always been a key part of what we do here with Hawaii Coffee. We need to continue to see that happen.
So let's move over to the other side of the work you do with the roasting, Rusty's Hawaiian Coffee. So how are the tariffs affecting a small-scale producer like Rusty's?
I think the tariffs really affect us and many small businesses like ours in several ways that people may not think about initially. So although our coffee is all here, homegrown in Hawaii, and we sell to a mostly local market, and we obviously have online sales, which go mostly to the U.S. or Canada as well, some of the challenges could come initially from international shipping. We have customers we've had in Canada. It's been a long time place where we've been able to send coffee and have people who enjoy our coffee. Maybe they visited and had some while they were here, or we've been able to reach them online. That changes a bit when you're shipping into Canada because tariffs can step in unpredictably there. When you're trying to get the small elements that you need to run your roaster business, like coffee bags, like 7 ounce or 1 pound bags to put the coffee in, now you get into supply chains that reach internationally for a lot of different businesses. We've gotten our bags from China in the past. It was a good price, it was good quality, so everything fit. The tariffs hit the way they did, and we need to resupply. We run into a problem of obviously an increased cost on one side, but on the other side, you also have limited space. We're a small business, so we can't order 20 or 30 or 40,000 bags and have them stored here. We just don't have place to put them. So we need smaller production runs at a price that still makes it affordable and doesn't drive the price of the packaging up. And China normally fit for us very well. When the tariffs hit so suddenly, you're kind of put into an uncomfortable position of trying to shift to a domestic producer immediately, and maybe the domestic options aren't as robust as you would need them to be to fit a small business like ours. And the same goes for the jute sacks that people put their coffees in. Jute sacks are normally made in India or China or Pakistan. And so there aren't places to go in the U.S. to find jute sacks, people who produce jute and make them into sacks, which is how we transport our coffee around. Those are things that would take time to change, to find new avenues, and you just can't do them immediately. So when the tariffs hit, as suddenly as they did, it puts people in a very tough position.
Well, I'm just thinking of all of the elements that go into growing and producing coffee. I'm thinking about fertilizer, right? I mean, you must utilize fertilizer. Where does that come from?
Yeah, that's another challenge. A lot of fertilizer has ingredients, for instance, like potash, and most of the potash comes from Canada. So when the tariffs hit in Canada, you saw a lot of agricultural companies and farms, even in the Midwest of the U.S., who were very concerned about what that would mean to their prices. And these are obviously giant farms that might be growing soybeans or growing corn or growing wheat. And when you're doing these negotiations, you're doing the tariffs, it changes their costs. Well, that filters down to a smaller business as well. You can have a local organic fertilizer, but if it's not produced at scale, you're still needing to try to find what you need for your farm that comes in from these other supply areas. And so we're very reliant on these interdependent chains of sourcing materials that we need for our U.S.-based businesses. Again, the difficulty comes in when the changes are so sudden and so extreme. Once people have time to adjust and maybe find alternatives, it makes it easier for a business, a small business especially. But when the changes come so suddenly, there just aren't other options available that you can turn to without incurring a great deal of cost, which hits your already narrow bottom line.
That makes sense. The speed at which the changes are coming, and also the, let's say, I guess, inconsistency of the changes. I mean, it sounds like when you were heading off to China, the rate might have been around 145%. When you arrived, it had been reduced, at least temporarily, to 30%. So it's this uncertainty.
Right? Exactly. And for any business, and a small business especially, uncertainty will make you hesitate. You're always looking to project forward if you're going to invest in a new roaster or a new roasting plant. Maybe you're going to build a facility. Maybe you want to expand to a couple more acres and grow a little bit more coffee. Maybe you want to diversify into a few other crops. That level of uncertainty about the costs for making your product and the cost to sell your product are going to make you hesitate and not move forward. You need to be able to project what you need. So when these levels of tariffs rise suddenly and then fall suddenly, and they only fall temporarily, you end up in a wait and see mode. And when you're growing a coffee farm, for instance, it takes 3 years for a coffee tree to produce any fruit at all, and 5 years for it to be 100%, you know, fully mature and producing coffee cherry to put into, to, you know, so you can pick it and create coffee. So you need to be able to have some level of certainty 5 years out that you're going to have a market, that the cost will be in line. And with this level of uncertainty, you really can't do it. It makes it a really difficult decision for a small farm and a small business, because you could really lose out big if things change again.
You know, we've been talking a lot about all of the elements that go into growing and roasting and making coffee, all the things you need, a fertilizer and packaging and a good roaster and facilities and so forth, but also human beings, right? Workers. Talk to us about your workforce, how stable it is for you these days.
I think that the industry is concerned about what is going on with the folks who help us harvest the coffee, who help in several areas of our industry. I mean, they're an integral part of our industry and in the community. For instance, if 30 or 40% of coffee can't be harvested, then it falls, and that's production that you've put money into that you can't make any money off of. You can't break even, let alone make a profit. That could really hit the industry.
I'm assuming that what you're alluding to there is immigration actions and large immigrant population that's a part of making coffee available to Americans and beyond.
Yes, that is definitely part of the level of concern. When you're seeing people that you know, and in Hawaii, everyone knows everyone, right? It's a big island, but it's a small community. So you know people who may have gone to school with someone who had something happen, or this is a neighbor, someone they work with, or a friend. And so it has a definite effect on the morale of the community. You got a lot of challenges and a hit to the people that underpin the workforce, and not just picking, but processing, roasting, etc. All of those kind of get hit with what we're seeing currently. I know there's a lot of concern of what it will mean in the next couple of months as the new harvest season begins. These effects start showing up at a very busy time of year for coffee, which is harvest season. And it just also really has an effect of like seeing friends and classmates, etc., seeing their lives get affected and how that affects them as individuals. I think there's a lot of concern about how this will affect going forward. And people are hoping to see a good solution come from it. We love being part of the Hawaii community. We want to be able to have a product that can be shared with everyone here in the island, with people in the U.S., people overseas, and to keep the connections over coffee that have gone on time immemorial. But this part of what's going on with the tariffs really makes it difficult to understand how we can keep going.
And I love the point you make about people sort of gathering around coffee. That's something we've seen since the Enlightenment, right? The coffee houses. And it's sort of a hallmark of socializing and gathering as human beings.
It's a good thing to reconnect over a cup of coffee. And whether you're in China, whether you're in Hawaii, if we can connect with each other through coffee, that's why I'm glad it resonates with you and the listeners here, and I think with everybody. Like you said, we all connect over coffee, talk about our world, talk about communities, just talk about our humanity. And yeah, we want to be able to continue to really do that. And hopefully these issues can get settled out so that we can continue to do that together.
That was Ralph Gaston of Rusty's Hawaiian Coffee and Isla Custom Coffees talking with HBR's D.W. Gibson. Give it some time. If I didn't love you, it would be fine. Cause if we do coffee, it's never just coffee. It's never just coffee.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
On the next Fresh Air, how J.D. Vance rose from a struggling Ohio steel town to Yale Law School, venture capital, and now the vice presidency. Along the way, he shed old convictions and adopted new ones, some deeply divisive. We'll speak with George Packer about his Atlantic Magazine article on Vance's transformation and what it reveals about the future of American politics. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
This month happens to be Mental Health Awareness Month, and today we highlight how the mental health of Hawaii farmers are being addressed. Noel Fuji'i Orire is with Overstory Hawaii. She talked with us this morning about a project called Seeds of Wellbeing.
The Seeds of Wellbeing, they have this peer mentor network that has been providing emotional support and sharing resources and essentially helping to destigmatize mental health in Hawaii's farming community. Nationally, farmers are 3.5 times more likely to die by suicide than the general population, according to the National Rural Health Association. But locally, there hasn't been much research done around farmers in Hawaii. And so Seeds of Wellbeing, in addition to that peer mentor network, they also did their own research. It was published in 2023, and it found that 51% of Hawaii's farmers reported being stressed, 35 have experienced mild or severe depression, and close to 8% have had suicidal thoughts. And so for farming, right, it is a field with a lot of uncertainty. There's no dedicated paycheck that you get like every 2 weeks. And there's so many things outside of a farmer's control, like weather, policies, pests, changing consumer demand. And so Seeds of Wellbeing, their research also found that in addition to uncertainty, major stressors impacting farmers' mental health included COVID-19, production concerns, like their ability to sell crops and how much production would cost, and then things like finances, like loss of income, debt, and cash flow. That research also found that certain demographics reported higher instances of experiencing depression or having suicidal thoughts. Nearly 50% of farmers under 46 said they've suffered from depression, and about 14% with suicidal thoughts. And then farmers of East Asian and Southeast Asian descent also reported higher rates. In addition to all of the stressors that farmers in general face, immigration status, shame of financial failure, and then stigma around disclosing mental health concerns might also be contributing to the mental health experiences that these folks are dealing with too.
And the number of farmers that we have from Asia is high.
Yeah, it is pretty high. According to the USDA's latest ag census, about 24% of our agricultural producers identify as Asian, but it doesn't break down how many of them are immigrant or second generation or things like that. But we have a very multi-ethnic farming community. And so like while nationally, right, I mean, Seeds of Wellbeing is part of a more national effort to address farmer mental health, but there hadn't been really any studies done in Hawaii before. Most of the studies that had been conducted had been done in more rural, Midwestern, and predominantly white communities.
And your story talks about how this organization has had its funding cut.
Seeds of Wellbeing was federally funded, and that funding was supposed to last through the end of this year. And its federal funding, they just got the stop order on it, so that funding is paused for the foreseeable future. The project director, I mean, she was planning to do another cohort of peer mentors, so train more farmers, ag support professionals, food hub staff in, right, mental health first aid and stress management and suicide prevention. But in the meantime, she is still getting requests for the resources that her project developed. So in addition to the peer mentor network, the project also has trainings and resource guide on mental health first aid specifically for the farming community and a podcast series and a Malama the Farmer campaign. And so there are still needs, right, to help support farmers with their mental health. And thankfully, the Peer Mentor Network, I mean, that's a network of 80 people that were trained to provide this emotional support and then bridge farmers in need to professional help. The peer mentors, they're also giving vouchers to folks in need for therapy. Each voucher is for 3 free therapy visit. The project has given away about 40 vouchers so far. So that's a pretty major thing, right? Because therapists are hard to come by. They can also be expensive. And right, it's also hard to find therapists that are knowledgeable about the farming field. So it's not like you can just take a week off, reduce your stress levels as a farmer because you have all of these crops and all this acreage that are under your care.
Yeah, so a lot of uncertainty for these farmers with this funding being paused. And I know that, you know, there is an effort at the legislature to help come up with some money to help nonprofits. I think the governor has yet to finish reviewing the bill, and I guess we'll see what gets funded at the end of the day.
Well, mental health has kind of been more of some folks described it as like a taboo topic within the farming community prior. I mean, Seeds of Wellbeing does still build on grassroots efforts to try and encourage more conversations around mental health. Hawaii Farmers Union United in particular, in 2019, they piloted what they call their hive tent at their annual convention. And so it was really just creating a space where folks can get together, just be present with one another and connect and check in with one another. And so actually, many of Hawaii Farmers Union United's leaders have become peer mentors under the Seeds of Wellbeing program.
Well, we certainly appreciate you highlighting this organization. But thank you so much, Noelle.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
That was Editor Noelle Fujii-Oride of Overstory Hawaii. You can read more on this issue at overstoryhawaii.org. President Donald Trump calls it his big, beautiful bill. The spending measure squeaked through the House by one vote, and we've been hearing a lot about how it may impact programs for the needy, like Medicaid. But it also touches renewable energy, which this Republican administration isn't really keen on. Here to talk about that is HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so not so good news for the renewable energy folks?
Yeah, based on folks I've been talking to, so as you said, this is a massive bill. It has thousands of pages. What I've specifically been tracking is what it means for the solar industry. And within that, I've really been looking at this huge rollback of tax credits that support renewable energy, both on the residential and the commercial side. And everyone I've talked to said that this would have a detrimental effect on the solar industry. Installations could be down as soon as the end of the year. But kind of counterintuitively, we might actually see a surge in new commercial projects first. And that's because there was this late-in-the-game addition to the bill that says developers will have just 60 days, if Donald Trump signs this bill, to break ground on projects, or they're going to lose out on commercial tax credits. But members of the solar industries that I've said, while that may sound like a good thing, Hawaii just actually isn't really set up to accommodate that kind of surge in business so quickly. So, for instance, Josh Powell, the CEO of Revolution, usually has to wait 6 to 8 months just to get county approval for a new commercial project on Oahu. And companies are also, meanwhile, bracing for higher prices because of tariffs. Here's what DC is in Government Affairs for SolarAy.
Hawaii is kind of a unique state from a logistics perspective, because a lot of the goods that come in Hawaii are what's called just in time, right? And so there aren't a lot of goods that are just sitting in warehouses collecting dust like you would have in, you know, where I live in Virginia, or like in Florida or Texas or something. You just have miles and miles of warehouses where stuff just sits until somebody orders it. You know, we really don't have that in Hawaii because we just don't have a lot of space. So what we're starting to see, and what we've already seen, is a lot of the manufacturers are telling us, hey, price increases are coming, so, you know, let your clients know. We're starting to get a lot of that inventory that came in under tariff. And so, like, you know, the next shipments of things that we're going to start to see are going to reflect some of those price increases, right? Just makes it more complicated, makes supply a lot harder to get. At the same time, you're having this kind of pressure to build a bunch of systems really quickly to get under the bill, but then you might not have that inventory available, or it might be more expensive than you would have otherwise wanted it to be.
Yeah, things are going to get tricky.
Yeah, interestingly, Josh Powell again with Revolucion said tariffs are very serious, but that demand surge will also affect prices.
I think the surge in demand will actually be the bigger problem, which is product availability. If you have a product availability issue, you're going to have increased prices as a result. We expect scarcity in the second half of the year because of the surge that's likely nationwide.
Boy, tough spot to be in.
Absolutely. So you have tariffs, of course, which are a global consideration, and then you have the rollback of federal support. But the Hawaii solar industry is also contending with a possible loss of a state-level renewable energy tax credit. And this is something, Catherine, that you and I have discussed before. It's one of the main pillars of our renewable energy industry. But lawmakers have sent a bill to the governor that would sunset that credit entirely in 5 years, or potentially reduce it by one-third every year. And I spoke with Ted Peck with the solar company Holuho about what that would mean for his business.
It's going to be problematic. It's going to force us to do, you know, a moonshot of trying to take our costs. We're doing a project now with Army Housing that we have exerted great effort to drive down our costs in order to provide them savings and provide us, you know, a rate of return on our installs. So we're going to have to roll up our sleeves and figure out ways to cut a third or more of our costs out. You know, the question is, how quickly can we do that? You know, solar with energy storage is quite costly. It's the most expensive component of a system. So it's going to be very challenging.
So it sounds like everybody's getting squeezed.
Yeah. So understandably, the solar industry, from their perspective, wants the governor to veto that bill. And if this triple whammy does hit, Will DC says that the solar industry is just going to look fundamentally different by the end of the year.
I would be surprised if the current industry in Hawaii that exists today, the amount of jobs that it has, exists in 6 months, if that were to occur. I think that we would see immediate devastating losses to local small and medium businesses like ours, clean energy businesses, EV businesses, energy efficiency businesses. You know, that's thousands and thousands of jobs in Hawaii. It's hundreds and millions of dollars of investments. I mean, billions of dollars of investments over, you know, the last 20 years, right? A lot of that would start to dry up towards the end of the year. And, you know, maybe we'd get this kind of artificial boost in the next few months as people try to, like, essentially get a run on the banks and try and get in before the party's over. But, I mean, Christmas looks pretty grim.
Yeah, not a good outlook.
Yeah. And so these four companies that I'm talking to, they're expecting the potential for layoffs in their industry. They are seeing a market contraction. They're going to be more conservative, but a conservative market means less progress on our state goals. So solar has been really instrumental in transitioning us away from fossil fuels. And to support that, just this year, Governor Josh Green came out with a resolution that said he wanted to see 50,000 new rooftop solar units installed by 2030, so 10,000 every year for the next 5 years. And the people that I've talked to, Josh Powell, Ted Peck, said that's just not feasible under these current conditions in this environment. Josh Powell said, we're going to be really strategic about what we take on. We're not going to try to do double the business we did last year. That's just a bad idea. And Ted Peck went even further when talking about the renewable energy tax credit. He said that if the state isn't going to provide a path for us to transition away from fossil fuels to meet the renewable portfolio standard we have to have 100% clean energy by 2045, they should consider repealing that goal, because they basically feel like they've been left out to dry in this current environment.
Yeah,
the other thing that...
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say the other thing that really came up again and again when I was talking to solar providers, as well as people like Gwen Yamamoto Lau at the Green Energy, Hawaii Green Infrastructure Bank, is that the people who are going to miss out if we see this contraction of the market are low to moderate income households. So folks who have not had the opportunity to adopt solar before, and who benefited from things like third-party leases, so investors who would put solar on the households of people who couldn't pay for the upfront costs or who had subsidies either at the federal or state level. Those folks are not going to be able to adopt solar and benefit or get things like lower energy bills in this environment.
Yeah, because it is an expensive outlay upfront. It's tough.
Yeah. So it remains to be seen. The House bill still has to go to the Senate, so it could change in that time. The timeline is really in June we'll be looking at that, but it could take longer. The Senate works on its own timeline, as many have told me. And we're also waiting on the governor to see if he'll take action to veto that state, that bill that revokes the state-level renewable energy tax credit. And that bill addresses a lot of different income tax credits, not just this one.
Right, and it looks, though, like the solar industry is looking at a triple whammy. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking with HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote about the passage of the major U.S. House bill and how it may impact the solar industry. Today's Mono Minute, we hear the calls of seabirds whose long red feather tails are prized for featherworking. Thanks to Zeno Kanto for these recordings. Here's the University of Hawaii at Hilo professor, Patrick Hart.
Kauai ula, or red-tailed tropic birds, are one of the most striking seabirds we might see around the Hawaiian Islands. Bright white with wingspans close to 4 feet, they have two long, streaming, bright red tail feathers that set them apart from all other birds. In earlier times, these feathers were highly valued by feather workers and were used in the making of kahili that often surrounded royalty. Kauai ula are well built for soaring above the ocean and are known to make spectacular dives from over 150 feet to catch fish and squid from near the ocean's surface. They rarely fish within sight of land and are known to follow boats to catch the flying fish that scatter as they move through the sea. Their calls have been described as a loud, sharp bark, sometimes with a piercing scream that's mostly heard around their breeding grounds. These tropic birds are found only across tropical latitudes of the Indian and Pacific Oceans. In Hawaii, they breed across all of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, as well as a few places on the main islands. After performing an impressive aerial courtship display that includes a series of backward somersaults, they lay just one egg, which is incubated and cared for by both parents. Unlike their white-tailed cousins that mainly nest on steep cliffs, Kauai ula usually nest on flat ground in the shade of low shrubs. This makes them very susceptible to mammalian predators like dogs and cats, which is why they rarely nest on any of the main Hawaiian islands. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Tune in to HPR2 on Monday at 8 p.m. for the last in our series of Hawaii Symphony Orchestra Masterworks concerts. Under the direction of Maestro Dane Lamb, we'll hear Stravinsky's Petrushka and La Mer by Claude Debussy. We'll also hear Nahoku Opio Fanfare and the Suite from Reis Hawaiki by Michael Thomas Fumai. That's Monday at 8 p.m. on HPR2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Ever wonder how the Hawaiian honey creepers get their curved bills? Well, the answer lies in the flowers of one of the bird's favorite plants. Lobeliads grow spectacular tubular flowers that honey creepers' bills fit perfectly in. Now, a new study uncovers clues into how this coevolution took place. Tom Givnish is a botanist and professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who has studied lobeliads since the 1980s. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his new research into this remarkable group of plants.
There have been over 140 species described, of which nearly 19% have gone extinct, so far as we can tell. They are, in fact, plants that are very hard for your listeners to see, even though you're in Hawaii. One of the problems is that the introduction of pigs and goats, deer, and other non-native herbivores have driven many of these species to the brink of extinction. In addition, a lot of habitat has been destroyed. And then finally, you have a lot of pollinators that have been lost, fruit dispersers have been lost, and introduced species of plants are competing with them. So it's actually sort of hard to see them in the wild in Hawaii. And when we were collecting these plants, we often had to go up steep slopes, around cliffs, climb up waterfalls to get them. It's possible to see them fairly easy in places like Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, Haleakala, slopes of Mount Tantalus on Oahu, and also the top of Kauai. But really, it's hard for most people to see them. Long tubular flowers, most of them curved, mirror image, not radially symmetric. Look a little bit like orchids in terms of the flowers. The flowers are pink, white, or red in color. There is one exception to this rule, Brighamia, the cliff-dwelling succulent, that has flowers that are nearly radially symmetric and are white and were pollinated by hawk moths, whereas all the others were pollinated by birds.
And one of the many examples that lobeliads are used for is that of coevolution, because if you compare the tubular flowers of some of these species, it matches up quite nicely with the beaks of Hawaii's endemic honey creepers. No,
that's exactly right, Maddie. Like a lot of bird-pollinated plants around the world, many of the lobeliads have long tubular flowers. Unlike a lot of the others, those tubular flowers are curved. They arch. And that matches the arch you see in the bills of the ivy, for example, or in the past, the o'o, which unfortunately now is extinct. It seems very clear that there was some coevolution, co-diversification of the Hawaiian honey creepers and perhaps also the Hawaiian honey eaters with the lobeliads. And unfortunately, we don't know very many of the details because many of the honey creepers have gone extinct, and the ones that are left are often rare. And so it's hard to actually study that. And only in the last 10, 15 years have people really conducted careful studies of pollination biology.
So you looked at hundreds of these little genetic snippets to be able to piece them basically into an evolutionary tree and say, this is what we think happened.
Yes.
And then piecing this together, you are able to tell quite a fascinating story about how all these species evolved to be where they are today. What island did they come to first? And then how did they get to subsequent islands as they erupted out of the sea?
Well, that's exactly right. So first of all, we came up with the family tree, the phylogeny of the Hawaiian lobeliads, and we dated that tree. Based on that, we inferred that the Hawaiian lobeliads initially arose about 12 million years ago. Kauai and Niihau are only about 5 million years ago. So clearly they arrived a long time before the current islands ever arose above the waterline. It appears likely that the lobeliads arose first on Gardiner, which is now represented just by a few pinnacles above the water surface. And furthermore, we concluded that starting about 10 million years ago, several different lineages of Hawaiian lobeliads diverged in a very short period of time, less than 100,000 years. It's a great example of adaptive radiation. listeners may be familiar with the Hawaiian Silver Swords, which is a famous group that has undergone adaptive radiation as well. And they've evolved a fair number of species, you know, 35 or 40 species, but the lobelias have three or four times that number. So having the family tree in hand and having it dated, we were able to also infer how different species got on different islands. We found that with the exception of one group from Polynesia, the Hawaiian lobelias are monophyletic. That is to say, they're all the descendants of a single common ancestor.
Wow.
And we found that most of the dispersal events between islands, more than 90% of them, have been from one island to the next adjacent and therefore the next younger island. And that makes sense in terms of ecological theory, because those new islands, as they're formed, would have been blank tables, right? They would not have had species present, no competitors. So that was sort of surprising because the Hawaiian lobelias are A, the largest group in Hawaii, and B, because so many of the species are restricted to single islands, we were able in this one study to provide more support for the so-called progression rule than really for any other group of Hawaiian plants or animals to date.
I just want to spend a second on the finding that so many members of this group are monophyletic, that they came from a single ancestor. And it makes you think that could have been a single introduction. And there's so much like randomness there that without that introduction of a single set of seeds, you might not have the most diverse group of plants in Hawaii.
Well, that's right. And it's even more surprising when you look at how different in form and ecology different groups of Hawaiian lobelias are. They're so divergent that initially it was thought that the lobelias represented up to five different colonizations of the Hawaiian Islands, despite the fact that they're the most isolated archipelago on Earth, and despite the fact that there's only one group of lobelias on all the other Pacific Islands. So it was really surprising.
And then what are some of the conservation implications of this type of research? Because you mentioned the lobelias are quite imperiled. The introduction of ungulates and the decline in native bird species, none of that can help. But how does kind of resolving how they're all related, where they came from, and how they evolved help us better preserve them in the future?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think that most likely it would be in terms of setting conservation priorities. So in a perfect world, which we do not live in, we would attempt to ensure that all the currently living species would be preserved into the indefinite future, that we would try to see to it as sentient beings, and they would not go extinct. And I have to say that Hawaii has, and the United States has made great efforts to help conserve the Hawaiian lobelias already in terms of declaring many of them endangered or threatened, in terms of the wonderful work by the National Tropical Botanical Garden and botanists like Ken Woods, Steve Perlman, who have gone out and rediscovered quite a few species, have collected seeds of many, not only of lobelias, but many other groups, put in the effort to cultivate them and in some cases to outplant them. But it may be that we don't have enough effort to save everything, in which case knowing which species are close relatives of each other could help guide special efforts to conserve certain species that are highly divergent, for example, from other species, or conceivably, though we have not encountered this yet, conceivably discovering new species hiding within currently described species. So I think in the short term, our research probably will help conservation of the lobelias by drawing attention to them, drawing attention to their really unparalleled diversification and adaptive radiation. They're the largest group of plants descended from a single ancestor on any archipelago around the world. And in terms of their variation in growth form and leaf shape and flower form, in elevations, habitats, they're really unequaled. And our hope is that by drawing attention to this group, which is extraordinary in so many different ways as a model for studies of evolution, that it will lead to redoubled efforts to help conserve the remaining lobelias.
That was botanist Tom Givnish talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to his new study about Hawaiian lobelias on our website after the show. Jazz and blues take center stage in Kailua-Kona this weekend. Friday kicks off the 12th year that Ken Martinez-Bergmeyer has put together the Big Island Jazz and Blues Festival at the Mauna Kea Beach Hotel. It's to feature more than a dozen acts from New Orleans, Chicago, and here in Hawaii over the four-day run.
We got Charlie Halloran, the Grammy winner from the Squirrel Nut Zippers, coming out. Going to be his debut coming out to Big Island. And 12 years we've been doing this now. It's unreal how time flies, huh?
And it's amazing because you do get a variety of folks in from jazz corners from across the country.
Yeah, it's amazing. We always seem to be focused on the New Orleans type feel, but we are bringing in some Chicago blues. We got Steve Freund. He's a Grammy legend from the Chicago area originally. And he's played with a lot of greats like Coco Taylor and a lot of the blues legends. And it's going to be his first time playing on the Big Island with us. And then, you know, we are going to do that New Orleans vibe with the Mardi Gras, with the big chief of Mardi Gras. We got Donald Harrison, who's also a NEA jazz master saxophonist from the HBO Treme TV series, which was all based about his life and his father, which won a whole bunch of Emmys. And we're also bringing in another big chief, his first time ever to Hawaii, Bruce Sunpai Barnes. He's a Zydeco Cajun accordion harmonica player. And he used to play with the NFL Chiefs as well. And then he kind of broke away and kind of followed his roots of his family and got back in playing Zydeco Cajun. He actually tours with Sting and just finished a tour doing with Paul Simon for like 3 years. And another New Orleans vibe we're doing is the Radiators, which is one of New Orleans' greatest Cajun rock. Really, it's just a great band, and they tour all over the world. And we have Camille Baudouin, one of the original members, lead guitarist, coming out to play. It'll be his first time playing for us at the Big Island. And, of course, Music Hall of Fame legend, Grammy winners, Wayne Toups. He's going to be doing his Louisiana Cajun Zydeco. And we're going to bring out a singer-songwriter. Her first time ever is Lynn Drury. And she kind of does this folk bluesy Americana vibe. And she's getting a lot of recognition, won a lot of awards, and her first time ever to Hawaii. And we're going to sneak her over here to Maui that following Thursday, and she's going to do a little show for us at the Ritz-Carlton, kind of a free concert thing. Kind of show her off on Maui, part of our Big Island Jazz and Blues Fest. And, of course, we always bring in the Iguanas, one of New Orleans' favorite bands. A lot of the music has been in a lot of movies. They travel nonstop, and they're going to come out, and they kind of be our rhythm section. It's always fun. And, you know, we tie in the Hawaiian vibe of it. We bring in Grammy winner and a Hoka winner, John Keawe, doing his slack key, kind of he calls it his slazz.
Slazz, I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, mix of jazz and slack key. And Hope Keawe, she's going to be doing our pule, Hawaiian blessing, and she's a great kumu, and has a hula halau over on the Big Island as well. So we're going to tie that in. We also are going to have two-time Nahoku winner Larry Dupio. He's going to do his blues guitar thing for us. And Bill Noble, who's won a couple Nahokus. He's a great saxophonist on the Big Island, born and raised. So it's going to be an exciting time at the Mauna Kea Beach Hotel Oceanfront. For 3 days, we're going to have it. Kick it off on Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And actually, 4 days. We do a Sunday jazz breakfast brunch thing, too, with the musicians.
Well, it's great because, you know, you do get a chance to see these folks, you know, live. Because you don't often have too many venues where you can get the saxophone players and the trumpet players, and it's a nice combination.
Yeah, it really is a mix. And, you know, and really the intimate thing about this, you know, you can actually come up and say hi and talk story with these guys, you know, at our festival. It's not like it's all barricaded off, you know, like, you know, you go to big concerts and stuff like that. It's really open. Like, we do some at the Copper Bar on a Friday night to meet and greet. It's an open-air, beautiful restaurant at the Mauna Kea, and you can actually come up and have a conversation with one of these musicians. You know, they're all so happy just to be here. And one thing they never get to do, these guys all play at the New Orleans Jazz Fest, which over a million people go, you know, and they never get a jam with each other. And that's one thing we have to highlight at the end. All of them are on stage at the same time, and it's incredible. And they say, man, we can't even do this back in New Orleans, which is really, it's a special moment. They're really epic and historic here for Hawaii.
So they get a chance to riff, really enjoy it.
Yeah, and they get to hang out, you know, for a few days. Usually when they go on tour, they're in a city and they leave the next day or, you know, day after. Here they get, you know, I bring them over here, they get to hang out for 5 days, enjoy their beaches, go on hikes, get in the ocean, and really feel that healing experience that we all know exists here, right, in Hawaii.
Well, you've been doing this now for 12 years. Where do you see this festival going?
You know, it's really been challenging at times. Luckily, the Mauna Kea Beach Resort, they see our vision, what we've done. They just spent $220 million on that resort last year, by the way, and they're still continuing working on it right now. But luckily, we have a team, Craig Anderson, who's the general manager, vice president, and Kansas Henderson, the hotel manager. They see our vision. They want to keep it going. The hotel does get sold out when we come, so we do bring something to it. You know, people do come. They fly in from Oahu. They fly in from Australia, California, Chicago, New York. You know, we get a lot of people from the inner islands even coming in. So, you know, I guess I'm going to keep going, being a kupuna now myself. You know, I love the feeling. It's a lot of work, but, you know, something tells me to keep doing it and, you know, keep going. And we're right now working on trying to do our 10th Maui Jazz and Blues Festival, working with the Possibility and Resort maybe this fall. We've done the Oahu Jazz and Blues Fest in the past, like 3 times. They're hitting me up, some of the resorts, saying, hey, can you bring it back over here to Oahu? So if I got the energy, Catherine, I'm going to do it.
You know, I know we went through some tough times with the pandemic and the shutdown. And, you know, I know over here on Oahu, we've lost some, you know, venues for the jazz musicians to play at.
And yeah, going through the pandemic, we had to cancel it 3 times. We had dates for the Big Island Jazz and Blues Fest. And, you know, every time new regulations came out. You remember those crazy times, right? And
yes.
Thank goodness we all made it through all that, and we're back going stronger than ever. And, you know, you're going to be able to see 20 musicians. There's not a lot of festivals to experience that, you know, so we're going to keep doing it. And if you've never been to the Big Island Jazz and Blues Fest, I welcome everyone to come. You will see so many happy people, happy faces. It's a wonderful experience.
The swinging time.
Okay, well, I hope you can get over here and see it too, Catherine.
All right, okay. Well, thanks so much, Ken. Appreciate it. And then as far as tickets?
Yeah, you can go to BigIslandJazzAndBluesFestival.com. Everything is all available there. And it's real simple. And you can, they're even doing some comma and room rates for us. Just mentioned the Jazz Fest at the Mauna Kea Beach Hotel and at the Hupuna Prince. And come in and enjoy some jazz, blues, zydeco, and roots music. It's going to be the finest.
We've been hearing from Ken Martinez-Bergmeyer talking about the upcoming Jazz and Blues Festival on the Kahala Coast this weekend. Look for links on our website later today.
In the afterlife, you could be headed for the serious strife. Now you make the scene all day, but tomorrow they'll be held to pay. Attentively, I mean about future calamity. I used to think the idea was obsolete until I...
Well, that does it for us today. But up tomorrow, we plan to take a look at how Hawaii's Musubi is taking New York City by storm. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website or go to Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.